Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Welcome to Hit Parade, a podcast of pop chart history from Slate Magazine about the hits from coast to coast. I'm Chris Melanfi, chart analyst, pop critic, and writer of Slate's Why Is This Song Number One series. On today's show, in early 1980, a single materialized on the charts that was so unusual it would inspire a former Beatle. More on that former Beatle in a moment. As for the song, which dated back to 1978, it was called Rock Lobster, and it was by a five-person band who named themselves after a collection of letters and numbers, designating both a 1950s military bomber and, more to the point, a 1960s bouffant hairdo, the B-52s. On first listen, the B-52s' Rock Lobster was a cavalcade of kitsch, but it also had the edge of punk, and its quirky surf guitar and primitive keyboards connected it to early rock and roll. It was old and new at the same time, the leading edge of rock's new wave. A little over 3 years after Rock Lobster peaked on Billboard's Hot 100, well shy of the top 40, another band that emerged in the aftermath of punk made its Hot 100 debut. By now, new wave pop was all over the charts, but nothing on the radio in 1983 sounded much like this band either. It was by four men who also named themselves with a string of letters, the abbreviation for Rapid Eye Movement, the dream phase of a deep night's sleep, R.E.M. Radio Free Europe, R.E.M.'s first pop hit, peaked even lower on the charts than Rock Lobster had. But its rustic, chiming sound would influence a generation of rock bands. What did the B-52s and R.E.M. have in common, other than band names that resembled codes and hits that weren't setting the charts on fire, at least not yet? They both hailed from a college town about 60 miles from Atlanta, the city and county of Athens, Georgia. And both groups were pivotal to the development of what would later be called alternative rock. As the B-52s and R.E.M. grew up alongside each other, they served as twin ambassadors for Athens as a southern hotbed of new wave rock and outsider art. They would even, by the 90s, appear on each other's records. Love, what it's doing, yet they sounded utterly distinct from each other and marked not only Athens' music, but all of New Wave as more an attitude and a musical ethic than a genre. One group was signed to a major label right from its debut album. The other one spent 5 albums on an independent before graduating to the majors. One group were avatars of kitsch, accessible tour guides to post-John Waters junk culture. The other were mysterious, elliptical, often indecipherable, but with a hard-edged backbone that enabled them to compete with the top rock acts on the radio. And the train conductor says, take a break, drive a break. Also notable in this Pride month of June, front people in both REM and the B-52s presented unapologetic, sui generis sexual identity, and even a sense of camp, in entirely different packages, long before these performers came out publicly. They were living gender fluidity in a rock context, decades before terms like non-binary or transgender were commonly understood in popular American culture. Much as there is now no one way to present one's identity, these two bands from the same southern city showed that there was no one way to be alternative. By the end of the 1980s, they became platinum sellers without compromising their sense of musical adventure. Each arrived at chart dominance via different routes. REM's was a steady climb from album to album as American rock gradually moved in their direction, while the B-52s underwent a mid-decade crisis that nearly ended their existence as a band. In this two-part episode of Hit Parade, we will explore the rise of these two bands from Athens, Georgia, the B-52s and REM, how they helped to invent swathes of what was first called New Wave, and how they sowed the seeds for what, by the 90s, was called alternative rock. In the early 80s, when they broke, Billboard had fewer charts to track different flavors of rock, and no modern or alternative rock chart at all. And what the B-52s and REM were doing was so new, radio programmers didn't entirely know what to make of it, which helps explain why their early singles charted so modestly on America's primary hit barometer, the Hot 100. And that, in this first part of our episode, is where your hit parade marches today, the week ending July 23rd, 1983, when REM quietly debuted on the Hot 100 all the way down at number 90 with their first ever single, Radio Free Europe. Just 7 spots below the B-52s, who were peaking in the chart's low 80s with their 7th single and only 3rd minor hit overall, Legal Tender. So I fixed up the basement with what I wasn't working with. Stuffed it full of jelly jars and heavy equipment. This episode of our show will be something new for us on Hit Parade. It's not only going to be our first multi-part episode, it's also our first show where we're focusing closely on alternative rock. Again, alt-rock didn't even have its own chart in Billboard, the music industry Bible, until the late 1980s. Of course, by then, this left-of-the-dial music, sometimes called post-punk, sometimes college rock, most often new wave, had been influencing popular culture for about a decade and a half. But before it could reach that level of radio ubiquity and platinum sales, the industry, the bands, and the fans had to agree upon what to call it, because consensus was not what alternative music was ever about. That's proto-punkers The New York Dolls with Personality Crisis, the lead track on their now legendary 1973 self-titled debut album. The Dolls, like Iggy and the Stooges before them, were punk before anybody knew what to call this music. Eventually, the group would come to be called glam punk, not least because the Dolls performed in drag, complete with platform heels and bouffant wigs, 4 years before the B-52s would do the same. The New York Dolls were playing with gender presentation and identity ahead of generations of other rock and pop acts. Even as they played what, to modern ears, sounds like a pretty classic form of tough-minded punk rock. Indeed, one of the most remarkable things about punk is how quickly it fused with other genres. Just in terms of nomenclature, a fairly select group of acts are only called punk. Sure, some first wave punk was simply that. For example, Queen's New York band The Ramones, whose 2- and 3-minute songs sometimes even had the word punk right in the title. To England's scandalous The Sex Pistols, who were punk in attitude as well as in sound. But from the jump, punk, which simply stood for boiling down rock to its core elements and as few chords as possible, moving away from the bloat of early to mid-70s rock, was getting hybridized, which helps explain how splinter movements like post-punk and new wave came to be in the first place. Whether it was the economical, twitchy art punk of Talking Heads, Psycho Killer, or the more pop-derived punk of Blondie. Like the Ramones and Talking Heads, Blondie, led by Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, cut their teeth at New York club CBGB. But they gravitated toward a range of genres, including power pop songs like The Nerve's Hanging on the Telephone. The B-52s would take cues from all of these splinter movements when they formed in 1977. Their formation, one night at a Chinese restaurant in Athens that served a potent rum cocktail, happened far from the punk mecca of New York City. And, to hear Kate Pearson tell it, Athens, home to the main campus of the University of Georgia, was not the likeliest place for a post-punk movement to take root. In an interview with People magazine celebrating the B-52's 40th anniversary as a band, Pearson said, quote, "It's funny, people think of Athens as music central, but it really had nothing happening. It was a farmer's town. The university was very separate, and it didn't really have a student-y downtown. There were 2 feed stores. There was a farmer's hardware," unquote. Added her bandmate Fred Schneider, quote, "We brought our own ideas." Schneider and Pearson were transplants to Georgia. Both were born and raised in different parts of New Jersey before moving to Athens, Fred to study at the university, and Kate just after college to live on a nearby farm with her friends. There they met Athens natives Keith Strickland and siblings Ricky and Cindy Wilson. Cindy told Rolling Stone in 1980 that what made Athens exceptional, politically and culturally, was the university. For a Georgia town, quote, "It's real liberal, mainly because of the college." Fred Schneider added, "It's such a loose town, the wilder the better. I mean, I would dress crazier for work than I do on stage." To hear the locals tell it, from the start, there was no one Athens sound. which made it an ideal place to nurture a range of music. Pearson told People magazine, quote, "There really was barely a music scene, so we weren't influenced by local music," unquote. The band members were aware of punk like the Sex Pistols. In fact, Kate later lamented in Rolling Stone magazine missing the Pistols' only show in Atlanta because she had to work a night shift at her crummy job at a local Athens newspaper. But the five friends' musical influences ranged even more widely than punk. They loved classic pop, but especially around 1976, when the Billboard charts were dominated by the likes of The Captain and Tennille and Barry Manilow, their tastes were too eclectic for the radio. Quote, "We didn't really listen to the top 40 ever," Schneider said. "We listened to the Velvet Underground, but also James Brown. I love Motown, and my favorite band of all time is Martha and the Vandellas." This was the other side of the B-52's equation. The 1970s were a good time for reevaluation of late 50s and early 60s music. Punk had brought back tight two-minute rock and roll. And in mainstream culture, 50s and 60s influences were running rampant in the decade of Grease, American Graffiti, and Happy Days. But the B-52s specifically gravitated towards certain forms of 50s and especially 60s pop. Like the Ramones, they loved girl groups, such as the Ronettes. They also liked kitschy pop, like Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. Or three-chord garage pop, like Question Mark and the Mysterians. You're always laughing, way down at me. All of these influences, the girl group harmonies, the keening organs, the party vibe, and the skeletal punk sound, would not only make their way into the B-52's music, it would later influence the sound of New Wave itself. By the 80s, numerous New Wave bands would mine 60s sounds, from the Go-Go's to Soft Cell. But back in 1977, the B-52s were helping to invent this sound from whole cloth. Recorded in early 1978, their first single sounded like a blueprint for New Wave. That's the original version of Rock Lobster, issued in 1978 by the tiny independent label DB Records, based in Atlanta. By indie standards, this first B-52 single was a sensation. The DB version of Rock Lobster sold roughly 20,000 copies. And its sound was truly original, in more ways than one. Three vocalists, all singing different parts, including a segment in the middle where they implore everyone dancing to drop down to the floor. Fred Schneider's vocals were recited in rhythm more than sung, in a kind of post-punk Sprechgesang, as the Germans call it. Kate Pearson's and Cindy Wilson's masked vocals featured high girl group harmonies and imagined noises of sea creatures, some of which Schneider made up, like the bikini whale. The lyrics were a gender-flipped reimagining of Annette Funicello-style beach party culture, with lines about boys in bikinis and girls on surfboards. Pearson played Farfisa organ, emulating the 60s acts they loved. And finally, the guitar, a guilelessly original kind of post-punk surf music on a Mosrite electric played by Ricky Wilson. Despite his interest in surf guitar, Wilson was no virtuosic shredder like legendary guitarists Dick Dale or Link Wray. In fact, Wilson's guitar often had broken or missing strings. Bandmate Keith Strickland, a sometime guitarist himself, claims he would break a string on Ricky's guitar and then not replace it. So both Strickland and Wilson would set up the Moe's Right with an open tuning, essentially allowing them to play both low, almost bass notes, and the lead notes at the same time. In the B-52's early years, Strickland was the band's drummer, and Wilson essentially handled guitar duties by himself. When Ricky Wilson came up with the surf riff for Rock Lobster, he told his sister and Strickland, quote, "I've just written the most stupid guitar riff ever." Rock Lobster. Rock Lobster. Rock Lobster. Rock Lobster. But that so-called stupid riff was a kind of accidental genius, and it powered the song. Playing in their small Bohemia of Athens, Georgia, the B-52s were both out of time and ahead of the curve. The single was recorded around the same time that other new wave acts in both New York and London were exploring elements of this same sound. For example, New Yorkers Blondie, right around the same time, put their own spin on girl group on their debut album with In the Flesh. And the sound of Farfisa organ was spreading all over post-punk music, including the first two albums by UK premier angry young man Elvis Costello. I was chilling in the shine and the light, not dial doing anything my radio advised. With everyone, Rock Lobster was all of these elements at once. It was a party record with punk cred. On the strength of the DB single of Rock Lobster, the B-52s drew interest from other labels. After moving to New York City and befriending CBGB regulars The Talking Heads, the B-52s signed with Talking Heads' manager. He got them contracts with two of the more adventurous major labels. In the U.S., Warner Brothers Records. And in the U.K. and other territories, Island Records. Thanks in part to their affiliation with Island Records, the band recorded their debut album with Island founder and producer Chris Blackwell, the legendary impresario who broke Bob Marley in the UK and the US and would later sign U2. Blackwell produced the B-52's album at his Compass Point studio in the Bahamas. The band later admitted they were surprised it didn't sound fuller or more expensive. Keith Strickland told a UK journalist, quote, "We just thought you go into a studio and you think you'll sound bigger and better or whatever, you know? But Chris really wanted to keep it stripped down and very minimal." It was minimal indeed. Released in the summer of 79, the B-52's self-titled debut album featured a lean 9 songs, all some form of new wave party tracks, including the strutting Dance This Mess Around and the skeletal, punky 52 Girls. The self-titled B-52's album also featured a re-recording of Rock Lobster that was longer and harder-edged. Where the DB Records version was speedy and only 4.5 minutes long, the Warner Brothers version was nearly 7 minutes long. At a time in the late 70s when FM radio and album-oriented rock dominated, longer tracks were no longer commercial suicide. The Warner version of Lobster closed with a gale force rave-up, egged on by screams from Fred and Cindy. Ricky tears into a slamming version of the guitar solo. Boys in the Released as a Warner Brothers single in the summer of 79, Rock Lobster was either a massive success or a pop underperformer, depending on your expectations. In the United Kingdom, it scraped the top 40, reaching number 37 in August of 1979. In America, Lobster took considerably longer to break, not even making the Hot 100 until the spring of 1980, and only reaching a peak of number 56 in May of that year. Not bad for such a cutting-edge single by a brand new band. Of course, by the end of the 70s, bands that had cut their teeth at CBGB were starting to score more serious hits. The Talking Heads and Patti Smith scored their first top 40 pop hits in 1978. And by 1979, the B-52's peers in Blondie were landing chart toppers that sounded like this. Even newer, more commercial new wave bands were topping the charts, like The Knack. Still, Warner Brothers had to be happy with the B-52s. Their album was both a critical and commercial success. On the Village Voices Paz and Jop poll at the end of 1979, the album, the B-52s, placed seventh, ranked alongside such classics as Elvis Costello's Armed Forces, Donna Summer's Bad Girls, and the American version of The Clash's self-titled debut. In fact, not counting that reissued U.S. Clash album, the B-52s was the only album by a new band in the top 10 of that critics' poll. It also sold exceptionally for a debut album. The LP rode Billboard's album chart for more than a year, and by the fall of 1980, the B-52s had gone gold for sales of 500,000 copies, on its way to platinum. Earlier in 1980, the band were even invited to perform on Saturday Night Live.
Ladies and gentlemen, the B-52s.
We were at a party. To hear about Belle and the D. Summer reached in and grabbed it. But the rock.
This is probably around the time a former Beatle first came across Rock Lobster, and he was wowed. In one of the final interviews before his murder in 1980, John Lennon told Rolling Stone, quote, "I was at a dance club one night in Bermuda. Upstairs they were playing disco, and downstairs I suddenly heard Rock Lobster by the B-52s for the first time. It sounds just like Yoko's music," unquote. Lennon was not only biased toward his wife, he was correct. Kate Pearson and Cindy Wilson were major fans of Yoko Ono. And on Rock Lobster, their sea creature sounds were direct homages to Ono's vocal style. When Lennon came back from Bermuda, he listened more closely to the B-52s. In his own words, not only the freshness of their sound, but also their gender parity as a band inspired him to both record again and work with his wife as a peer on an album for the first time.
I dug out the old records we'd made. I dug out the B-52s, and then I talked to my assistant who tried to turn me on to them 18 months before, but I said, no, I'm not into the music now. I didn't want to hear anything. He was trying to play me Pretenders and Madness and all that stuff, and I didn't want to listen to it. And I said, give me some more of this. What's going on out there? He brought all this, you know, cookie, whatever you want to call it, stuff in, and we looked at each other and we said, ha-ha. They finally caught up to what we were trying to do all the time, which is another form of expression.
Yeah,
I held her in the chair and said, listen to this Rock Lobster. Listen to this stuff. But I wouldn't have done it if we hadn't done it together. That was the point which your insecurity makes you say that. But the fact is, if I couldn't have worked with her, I wouldn't have bothered.
The result was Lennon's first album in 5 years, his final recording, and his only album-length collaboration with Yoko, Double Fantasy. Ono's tracks from Double Fantasy even sounded like new wave responses to the B-52's sound. The B-52s were honored to have inspired both Lennon and Ono, even though they only read Lennon's comments after the former Beatle was killed in December 1980. As for the band, by late 1980, they were already on to their second album, Wild Planet, which, like its predecessor, was executive produced by Chris Blackwell and would ride the charts for about half a year before going gold in 1981. Like its predecessor, however, Wild Planet generated only one charting single, and it was a fairly minor hit. Private Idaho, a shimmying party track, which, a decade later, would inspire the title of the Gus Van Sant River Phoenix movie My Own Private Idaho, managed to get only as high on the Hot 100 as number 74 in late 1980. The catalyst for New Wave's commercial renaissance in the United States would not arrive until late 1981. That catalyst was the launch of MTV, which we talked about in last month's episode of Hit Parade. Oddly, as visually striking and colorful as they were, the B-52s had not done much with the music video art form. None of the tracks on either of their first two albums had formal music videos, even as other new wave acts of the period, like Devo, were prophetically making videos in 1979 and 1980, even before MTV existed. As the video age kicked off, 1981 and 82 should have been an age of conquest for the B-52s. But this was when the band's run of good luck began to turn. The B-52s' management had gotten the band's friend David Byrne of Talking Heads to agree to produce their third album, 1982's Mesopotamia. Rather than being a triumph, the album was a mess, done in by label pressure and Byrne's own attempts to move the band toward a heavily overdubbed, percussion-driven sound better suited to Talking Heads, and his own work with Brian Eno on albums like My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. What was intended to be a full-length B-52s album was aborted midway through the sessions and ultimately turned into an EP of just 6 tracks. And, amazingly for a new wave album in 1982, none of the Mesopotamia songs spawned music videos, denying the B-52s a chance to capitalize on the MTV explosion. In fact, the B-52s would not release their first official MTV video until 1983's Whammy, their full-length album comeback. Whammy was a decent seller. It reached the top 30, and while it would not be certified for years, it ultimately went gold. Still, even with a glossy music video for the song Legal Tender, which was built around catchy synthesizers echoing the sound of current pop, the single could only manage a Hot 100 peak of number 81. This in the year that Eurythmics and Culture Club were breaking big on the US charts. At a time when androgyny was doing better than ever on the hit parade, the B-52's campy and queer-friendly music should have been a better fit. That's when the B-52's went on a long hiatus, for reasons that would not be revealed for another 2 years. Coincidentally, 1983 is when another band, hailing from the same southern town and just a few years younger than the B-52s, began breaking on the charts. And like their big brothers and sisters, this band started on a tiny regional label and, at first, sounded much closer to punk. That's Radio Free Europe, the debut single on Hibtone Records by REM, perhaps the most famous foursome ever to emerge from Athens, Georgia.
Introduce the members of the band.
It's Mike Mills, he's the bass player.
Uh-huh.
Bill Berry, the drummer.
Bill.
Michael Stipe, the singer.
Michael.
And me, Peter Buck.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. REM's ties to the Athens scene were even stronger than the B-52s. All four members had moved either to Athens or to nearby Macon, Georgia, in their teenage years. And they were serious appreciators of an eclectic range of music. In many ways, the sound of REM scarcely resembled that of the B-52s, reinforcing Kate Pearson's and Fred Schneider's point that Athens had no one sound. What the two bands had in common, however, was their fearlessness and an utterly original synthesis of numerous influences. And make no mistake, when it came to REM, the influences ran deep.
There she goes again. She's out on the streets again. She's down on her knees, my friend. But you know she'll never ask.
The Velvet Underground are forebears for a slew of bands. As I noted earlier, the B-52s themselves cited the Velvets as a key influence. And Brian Eno's famous quote about how all 30,000 people who bought the Velvets' debut album formed a band is so oft repeated it's become a cliche. To many musicians and music appreciators, even before the Stooges and the New York Dolls, the Velvet Underground, especially in its years fronted by Lou Reed, are the true inventors of punk and alternative music. By the late 70s, the Velvets' LPs, which had never sold all that well in the first place, had largely gone out of print. REM guitarist Peter Buck reminds fans of this often in interviews. In Buck's early 20s, the Velvet Underground was music for crate diggers and hardcore music nerds. And that's how Buck and future singer Michael Stipe met in 1979, when Buck was a clerk at an Athens music shop called Wuxtree Records. It actually started as mild annoyance. All the deep cut albums that Buck would set aside for himself at the shop, Stipe would dig out and buy. Eventually, the two bonded over their shared love of the Velvets and CBGB rock legends Television. More than a quarter century later, when Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder inducted them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Vedder complimented the band by saying, quote, "Peter Buck plays guitar like a guy who worked in a record store." Buck's signature guitar chimes, marked by broken arpeggiated chords, would later be called jangle, a rock critic term that dated to the 70s. Among the places Buck had picked up the jangle sound was such 70s power pop acts as the Alex Chilton-fronted Memphis band Big Star. Buck's sound would also be compared by some critics to 60s hitmakers The Byrds, specifically Rickenbacker player Roger McGinn. But Buck himself disputed this, claiming he was more influenced by the version of The Byrds that was led by country rock legend Gram Parsons. Buck particularly loved Parsons' later solo work with country rock legend Emmylou Harris. The band's early producers were themselves fans and players of jangly guitar. Mitch Easter played with North Carolina band Let's Active, and Don Dixon was a singer-songwriter and producer from South Carolina. In a 1998 VH1 interview, Dixon said Buck's guitar playing and Mike Mills' bass playing were intuitive, almost naive. Quote, "Mike played bass parts that were not traditional bass parts, and Peter used what he knew about guitar, which was kind of limited, to really great effect," unquote. In other words, like Ricky Wilson and his unusual Mozart guitar tunings for the B-52s, Buck and Mills were using their relative inexperience to create something novel. As for Michael Stipe, he, along with Buck, was a student of punk and post-punk, with particular admiration for the minimal, catchy British art punk band Wire. And as a lyricist, Stipe's impressionistic images drew heavily, if indirectly, from his favorite album of all time, Horses, the 1975 debut from androgynous punk priestess Patti Smith. Stars, because when he looked up, they started to slip. Then he put his head in the crooks of his arms and he started to drift, drift, drift. When they began playing Athens Club's The 40 Watt in 1980 and Tyrone's in 1981, they were already drawing hundreds of people a night. REM issued its first single in 1981 on the short-lived Athens label Hibtone, at a speed so jittery it could almost be termed punk. When Radio Free Europe later appeared on REM's full-length debut album in 1983, the track would be considerably slower. But what fans also noticed right away was that Stipe, who did not publish his lyrics, sang phrases that were almost incomprehensible. Raving station, calling on in transit. The single's B-side, a song called Sitting Still, would also wind up on the 83 album, but it was even harder to parse. Its pre-chorus seemed to be about a woman named Katie buying or maybe barring a kitchen. For REM, Stipe's open-to-interpretation lyrics were a feature, not a bug. And they continued on the band's first non-single release, a 1982 EP called, elliptically enough, Chronic Town. Chronic Town was also REM's first release on IRS Records, a quasi-independent label founded by Miles Copeland. And, as Mike Mills told VH1, signing to a label with more limited resources was more or less by design.
We wanted two things once we started approaching the business, or the business started approaching us. We wanted to never be in debt, and we wanted to have total control over everything we did. IRS was the perfect company for that because they wouldn't spend any money on anybody anyway.
During the 1980s, IRS was the little label that could. It had distribution via major labels, including A&M Records and MCA. But it was indie-minded and scrappy, generating hits from a spate of new wave acts, from the Go-Go's to Fine Young Cannibals. And Miles Copeland was part of a music business family. Brother Ian Copeland was a music promoter and booking agent for many of the day's top new wave acts. And, oh yeah, his other brother, Stuart Copeland, was drummer for the Police. Of course, by 1982, a version of New Wave had finally broken on the US charts, fueled by MTV and led by UK synthesizer bands like The Human League and A Flock of Seagulls. However, REM eschewed this form of new wave. In his earliest interviews, the opinionated Peter Buck openly scoffed at bands like the Seagulls. The sound REM was building was a completely different branch of the post-punk new wave family tree, rooted in Americana and foregrounded by the interplay of Buck's guitar, Bill Berry's cracking drums, Mike Mills's loping bass lines and keening harmonies, and Michael Stipe's unconventional voice and cryptic lyrics. This slower version of Radio Free Europe was track one on Murmur, REM's full-length 1983 debut album, produced by the team of Don Dixon and Mitch Easter. The album's cover depicted kudzu, the rapacious weed common to much of the southeastern United States. While Stipe's lyrics remained difficult to decipher, when he wanted to, he could offer a clear romantic lyric, as on the album's centerpiece ballad, Talk About the Passion. The arrival of Murmur in the spring of 1983 also heralded the arrival of Athens rock and jangle pop in general. REM were the most popular avatars of a sound that was associated with the American South, even when it wasn't from Athens specifically. For a while in the mid-1980s, the sound of American indie rock was the sound of chiming arpeggiated chords and a kind of doom dance rhythm. Whether from acclaimed Athens band Pylon, can you want to Mitch Easter's own band from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Let's Active. Or a group led by Michael Stipe's sister, Linda Stipe, and featuring guitar from a young Matthew Sweet, the Athens band O.O.K. As for Murmur itself, it charted surprisingly well. Debuting on the Billboard album chart in mid-May of 83, Murmur managed to scrape the top 40 by the summer. In mid-August, Murmur peaked at number 36 on the album chart, the same week the Radio Free Europe single reached number 78 on the Hot 100. All this for an album and single that sounded atypical for 1983 and were issued by an independent label, and with a shy singer who was hard to decipher. In live performances, Michael Stipe would all but hide behind his hair, a halo of curly tresses that covered his forehead and sometimes half his face. When REM played NBC's Late Night with David Letterman, Stipe actually hid behind Peter Buck when Letterman approached the band to say hi. But the performance was indelible. The night of the band's TV debut, October 6, 1983, Murmur had been riding the Billboard album chart for nearly half the year.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I mentioned earlier the Los Angeles Times just named this album one of the five best released so far in 1983. It's called Murmur. It's by a group of gentlemen from Athens, Georgia, called REM, and we're happy to have them making their national television debut with us tonight. Please welcome REM.
That wasn't the only way REM exceeded expectations in 1983. At the end of the year, the critics in Rolling Stone named Murmur 1983's Album of the Year, a giant killer. The magazine's critics placed REM's full-length debut above Michael Jackson's Thriller, The Police's Synchronicity, and U2's War. Nothing changes on New Year's Day.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
While they were on The Letterman Show in the fall of 83, REM performed a new song that didn't even have a formal title yet.
Now, the song you're going to do now is a brand new song. You want to explain the name of it or anything about it?
It doesn't have one. It's too new.
Too new to be named. All right. Are you gentlemen ready? Thank you very much for being here, folks. Nice meeting you guys. Ladies and gentlemen, REM.
That new track would eventually wind up with the arch title South Central Rain, a phrase Stipe never actually sings in the song. It could just as easily have been called Sorry.
Sorry. Sorry.
More important, South Central Rain served as a preview of REM's quickly recorded sophomore album, Reckoning. Released in April 1984, Reckoning became an even bigger hit, reaching number 27 by June and riding the album chart for just over a year. Unfortunately, IRS's efforts to get REM to the next level didn't bear much fruit. South Central Rain could only manage a number 85 peak on the Hot 100 in the summer of 84. And the follow-up, Don't Go Back to Rockville, didn't make the pop chart at all. REM were ready for a shakeup. Like its predecessor, Murmur, Reckoning had been produced by the team of Don Dixon and Mitch Easter. For album number 3, REM would travel to London to record with British producer Joe Boyd. A titan in the UK folk scene, Boyd had discovered, mentored, and produced Fairport Convention and Nick Drake.
I could have been one of these things first.
REM's third album was recorded during a cold London winter that tried the band's patience and almost led to their breakup. It was the first and last album the foursome would record overseas. Ironically enough, the album REM recorded with Boyd in 1985 would be their most American-sounding to date, a meditation on rustic Southern folk and rock that was more ruminative than anything they'd done before. As dark and insular as much of Fables of the Reconstruction sounded, it also featured REM's strongest attempts yet to produce bright, commercial-sounding radio hits. The album was led by an up-tempo, festive single about driving the back roads of America, Can't Get There From Here. IRS Records was so intent on improving the band's profile, the video for Can't Get There even featured subtitles. MTV viewers could finally sing along with Michael Stipe's abstruse lyrics, lines like Bad to Swallow You Whole and Philomath, They Know the Lowdown. For a second single, the band went with Driver 8, an infectious classic rock song with an evocative, unusually straightforward lyric from Stipe about a workman laboring on a Southern railroad line, and a Peter Buck guitar hook reminiscent of vintage Neil Young. And the train conductor says, take a break, driver eight, take a break, we can't reach our destination. Still each REM album on IRS Records was doing a little bit better than the last. Fables of the Reconstruction virtually matched the peak position of Reckoning, hitting number 28 in the summer of 85. On Billboard's album rock chart, Can't Get There From Here reached number 14, and Driver 8 hit number 22, the biggest radio hits the band had scored to date. But on top 40 radio, still then dominated by synth pop, REM were nowhere to be found. So, IRS sought other avenues to promote the band, including a TV show the label itself produced for MTV called IRS Presents The Cutting Edge. The show featured a range of independent and college-friendly rock bands, some of which were not on IRS itself, including a very young Red Hot Chili Peppers. But REM were given a prominent showcase.
You can't really expect to be inspired or you know, hit the right thing all the time. And rather than force it and really push something to try to make it, you know, a right song, you just, you do it, and if it doesn't come out right in about 20 minutes, really, it doesn't work. I read something that Sky Saxon, the guy that was in The Seed, said, and he said, any song that takes more than 20 minutes to write is not worth writing.
During most of 1983 and all of 1984 and 85, REM were the face of Athens rock. And their older siblings, the B-52s, were off the radar almost entirely. From 1979 to 83, the B-52s had been very prolific, releasing three studio albums, a remix album, and an EP. But after 1983's Whammy, the B-52s went more than 3 years without releasing any new music. Late in 1985, the band finally revealed why. In part two of our Deadbeat Club edition, we'll talk about how the B-52s faced tragedy and came back. We'll reveal what finally made them and REM hitmakers.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left.
And we'll talk about how the launch of a new Billboard chart helped fuel their success just before the 90s version of alternative rock took over the hit parade. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Hit Parade. Special thanks to critic and reporter Annie Zaleski, whose research on both REM and the B-52s were invaluable to me. Papers by her and by Grace Elizabeth Hale at this year's pop conference in Seattle provided major inspiration for this episode. My Hit Parade producer is Chris Berube, and we had help this episode from Danielle Hewitt and Dan Berube. The managing producer of Slate Podcasts is June Thomas. Our senior producer is TJ Raphael. And Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Check out their roster of shows at slate.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to Hit Parade wherever you get your podcasts, in addition to finding it in the Slate Culture Gabfest feed. If you're subscribing on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us while you're there. It helps other listeners find the show. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to leading the Hit Parade back your way. We'll see you for part two in a couple of weeks. Until then, keep on marching on the one. I'm Chris Malone.